The Guardian.
Welcome to Politics Weekly Extra. I'm Jonathan Friedland. For the last month, we've been focusing on the presidential election on the 3rd of November. But of course, that is not the only contest that day. There are hundreds of other races going on at that very same moment. All 435 seats in the House of Representatives are up for grabs, as are just over a third of the seats in the upper house, the Senate. And those battles for the Senate really count. In case you needed a reminder of how much they matter, a reminder did come on Friday night.
We are coming on the air at this hour because CBS News has confirmed that Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has died at the age of 87 from complications.
The Senate has more than sufficient time to process a nomination.
If that was how Leader McConnell and Senate Republicans justified their mindless obstruction of President Obama's nominee, surely they must abide by their own standard.
I will be putting forth a nominee next week. It will be a woman.
We're now gearing up for an almighty battle, because while it's the president who gets to nominate a replacement for Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court, it's the Senate that makes the final decision on that choice. And remember, the Supreme Court decides vital questions on abortion rights, on healthcare, on the climate crisis. And if Donald Trump gets his choice, there'll be a right-wing majority on that court for decades to come. All of which helps explain why the question we're tackling this week is: how important is the 2020 battle for the United States Senate? And to help me answer it, I'm joined by the senior political reporter for Guardian US, Daniel Strauss. Daniel, very, very good to have you on. First of all, just talk us through really the mechanics of this, how it works. Is it just that people turn up at the same place and the same time and vote? Or can there be differences, for example, in the turnout, where some people vote in the presidential election but not in the Senate races? How does it work?
So, right. We have election day on November 3rd, and to vote, you are given a ballot, and there's a list of candidates, which include the presidential candidate, the candidates for Senate, and congressional candidates, depending on which state you're in. And what's important here is that folks will be able to vote for Joe Biden or Donald Trump. And then if they're in a state where a Senate race is happening, also the candidates for Senate. It used to be that ticket splitting, where you would vote for a candidate for one party and then a different candidate for a different office, was much more common. But in the last few election cycles, a high level of partisanship has resulted in a very commonplace situation where a voter will vote just straight part down the party line.
Now, I mentioned that there are one third of the Senate, more or less, up every 2 years. The whole of the House goes every 2 years, but it's one third of the Senate, which translates, with a couple of special elections here and there, into 35 races this year. Now, normally, I know there are dozens that get no coverage, and in fact, almost barely any campaigning. I mean, no TV ads or anything, because they're in what we would call here safe seats. And so that means all the interest focuses on the ones that could go either way. And are there more of those hotly contested seats this year than normal?
I mean, there are a dozen of races, and because the president, the incumbent president, is less popular than he is unpopular, that usually indicates that down ticket races like ones for the Senate are going to be more competitive as well. There's a ripple effect from the presidential election downward. This cycle, there are more competitive Republican seats up for re-election than Democratic ones, but that's partially because Republicans control the majority of Senate seats right now. And the expectation is that the Democrats have a good chance to get three or four seats to regain control of the chamber, and they have a pretty good chance of that.
Because, as you say, I think right now the Republicans have 53 senators to 47 grouping together on the other side. But it's not just straightforward that therefore if the Democrats win three more, they are suddenly in charge, because it depends a bit on the presidential election as well. Can you just talk us through what exactly is the sort of winning post here?
Right. I mean, it would be a filibuster-proof majority, and a filibuster is a rule that allows the minority in the chamber to block legislation moved by the majority. It's unlikely that Democrats will regain a majority of support in the chamber, so the likelihood is that they're going to fall short of that. And it also depends on the presidency. If Joe Biden wins the presidency and Democrats regain control of the Senate, they are much likelier to have success moving legislation if only one of those things happens. So Joe Biden is elected president, but Republicans retain control of the chamber, albeit narrowly, which is a highly possible situation. We're going to see more gridlock in the next few years.
We just should say something here, again, because we're talking in a way about the whole nature of this institution. There is something sort of shockingly unrepresentative about the Senate. It's, but you know, maybe some people think it's part of the founding glory of the country, but Democrats can win millions more votes in Senate elections, but still get fewer seats because, say, people always pick Wyoming, I think, has the smallest population relative to its size. It's less than a million. It's in the hundreds of thousands. But they get two senators, and then California, not that far away, upwards of 30 million people, they also only get two senators. So that gives the Republicans a kind of built-in bias in the Senate. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the situation right now. Unless Democrats somehow make substantial gains in rural states and states where that right now reliably vote Republican, they will always have a disadvantage because every state is allotted two senators. It's not like the House of Representatives where the number of members of Congress per state is apportioned by population.
Senate Republicans who know deep down what is right for the country and consistent with the Constitution.
But as you say, the vacancy, this unexpected vacancy caused by the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, has dramatized why the Senate matters. Does the Senate actually matter that much? And the reason why I ask that is that this decision about filling that vacancy is not going to wait, is it? Because Donald Trump has said he's going to announce his choice, the person he's picked for the Ginsburg seat, on Saturday afternoon. And the Republican leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, has said that he's going to make sure that this current Senate is going to vote on that choice. And so surely that means even if voters, you know, throw out a whole lot of Republicans on the 3rd of November, it's still this group of seated senators, it's them who are going to get to decide on the replacement one way or the other. Does the Senate and senators really make much of a difference in terms of choosing how to replace this all-important vacancy on the court?
There's a period called the lame duck period after an election where the class of lawmakers from the previous election cycle stay in office until there's a handover of power to the new class. So in that situation, which is what you're talking about here, even if Donald Trump and Republicans all were voted out of office, they would still have a period of time where they could confirm a new Supreme Court justice. And Democrats can stall this, but realistically, there will be a new Supreme Court justice, and this class of lawmakers will confirm that person.
If you're a Republican candidate in some of those, you know, nail-biting states, what do you prefer? Do you prefer for this to have been out of the way and that then voters reward you by voting, saying thank you for putting in this new judge? Or do you want it still in play as a way of sort of motivating your voters? If Republicans candidates in the field, where do you think they fall on this issue of when this appointment, this vacancy should be filled?
It depends on the Senate race. There's a vulnerable senator in Colorado, which is an increasingly Democratic-leaning state, where the common view is that an extended discussion or focus on the Supreme Court vacancy could hurt him, that they will vote this Senator Cory Gardner out.
I'm just doing my constitutional obligation. I have an obligation to do this.
The saving grace of Donald Trump has been that he has been able to satiate the evangelical community of voters in this country by picking conservative Supreme Court justices on the high court. That's really buoyed him in cases where otherwise a bigger swath of the Republican community would be repelled by him. But he's been a vessel for moving the Supreme Court further to the right.
Let's get into talking about those specific races, though. You did mention one of them before, but tell us where there's excitement, particularly, I suppose, on the Democratic side, about their chances of flipping a state, to wresting it from Republican hands and into Democratic hands. What are the ones they are themselves, Democrats, excited by?
I mean, there are a few Senate seats. There's the Colorado one I mentioned. There is one in North Carolina, which I think is maybe one of the more interesting ones because it is a state that oftentimes votes Republican. And the incumbent senator there, Tom Tillis, was the surprise victor when he defeated the now deceased Senator Kay Hagan. There's always going to be hope among Democrats that they're going to flip Georgia and win some kind of statewide election there. I don't think that's going to happen. There's not much evidence that that will happen, but, you know, hope endures. Beyond that, I also would point to Arizona, which already has a Democratic senator, even though it's a Republican-leaning state.
Mark Kelly, the Democrat, Martha McSally, the Republican. The issue.
Now, the important thing to keep in mind about this race is that it is to fill the vacancy from John McCain's death. So the candidate who wins this race, if it's the Democrat, if it's Mark Kelly, he would be seated in the chamber sooner than the rest of the incoming class. And that could complicate the calculus for Mitch McConnell. I'd also point to Maine.
And here you go. The Democrat, according to Quinnipiac's new poll, Sarah Gideon, look at this. They have a 12-point lead for Gideon, the Democrat, over Susan Collins. Susan Collins.
Where a longstanding Republican senator, Susan Collins, is facing a tough reelection fight from a local lawmaker there named Sarah Gideon. Now, Collins has always portrayed herself as the consummate bipartisan dealmaker. There is a contentious vote. Susan Collins says, "I'm undecided." There's a huge amount of attention on her. And then she announces, "I've decided I'm going to vote with the Republican caucus on this thing." It's not very surprising anymore. It used to be, but you know, as we've seen an increase in partisanship and a sort of demise of moderates in this American politics, she's sort of sided with being a reliable Republican on major votes.
Now, we've been talking about Republicans who are vulnerable. There are some incumbent Democrats who are in tough races too, right?
Yes.
The Democrat who is seen as most vulnerable of all the senators up for re-election is Doug Jones of Alabama, and he joins us now.
The number one example is Doug Jones, a senator from Alabama who won in a contentious election in 2017. He's a Democrat in a state that is one of the most conservative ones in the country. He is very unlikely to win re-election.
Just the presence of an election looming over the horizon does influence, doesn't it, how the senators start behaving, how they vote. They've got these very long terms of 6 years, but you can always see a change usually in the last 2 years of their term. And the person I've got in mind particularly, I'm just interested to know what you make of him. I think the Americans say Lindsey Graham, we would pronounce it Lindsey Graham, in South Carolina, who we mentioned before, John McCain. He used to be John McCain's best buddy. He was very critical of Donald Trump.
He's a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot. He doesn't represent my party.
He's in a re-election fight right now, and he's sort of beginning to drink the Trump Kool-Aid in quite a major way, including on this Supreme Court issue, isn't he?
There have been moments where Lindsey Graham, who actually did run for president in the same primary as Donald Trump, has strongly disagreed and voiced his dissatisfaction with the president. But since Donald Trump was elected and put in office, he's been pretty agreeable with the president. There's a clip of Graham basically saying that in this situation with the Supreme Court, he would prefer to wait until after the election and after the winner of that election is in office.
I want you to use my words against me. If there's a Republican president in 2016 and a vacancy occurs in the last year of the first term, you can say Lindsey Graham said, let's let the next president, whoever it might be, make that nomination.
And but now he's saying the opposite, that he supports installing Donald Trump's nominee as soon as possible. And yeah, to my great surprise, actually, he is facing a serious fight to face a Democrat named Jamie Harrison, who has been basically a team player for the Democratic Party for some time now. Here, what we're seeing is that there is a likelihood that Harrison could beat Graham. He's only trailing by 1 or 2 points behind the incumbent senator, which to me is pretty amazing. It's hard for Democrats to win in conservative leading states like South Carolina.
We've all been through a lot together, and we probably deserve that hand for all of us.
How much influence do you see that Trump is helping or hurting Republican candidates, and how much is Joe Biden helping or hurting Democrats?
I mean, it's always hard to tell. There's definitely a large amount of enthusiasm for Democrats and a sense that, you know, if you want Democrats to have power, if you want to see Democratic legislative victories, you have to vote up and down the ticket. It is not just voting for a president or a senator and leaving other votes blank on your ballot. Joe Biden has run for president multiple times and has been in public view for decades. There's never been like a Joe Biden movement. There's never been a Democrats for Biden or the phrase, I'm a Biden Democrat. But the enthusiasm for Democrats to oust Trump and Republicans is very, very high. And I think that's what we're going to see here. But look, that's what a lot of really smart people said in 2016. And what happened in the end was that Donald Trump and the enthusiasm for him had a ripple effect down the ticket.
But in terms of the Senate, do Democrats who you speak to feel their chances are pretty good for retaking the Senate?
There are more competitive Senate seats where Democrats are on defense, and the number of competitive seats is much bigger than the number of seats Democrats need to win to take control of the chamber. That's as close as you're going to get for me, John.
Very good. Thank you, Daniel. Now, we always ask whoever's on the podcast what else is going on, and I thought we would talk this week about Donald Trump's comments late on Wednesday when he was asked by a reporter if he would commit to a peaceful transfer of power.
Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transfer of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
People are rioting.
Sort of boilerplate question that any candidate would always say yes. He didn't say yes.
Get rid of the ballots and you'll have a very we'll have a very peaceful, there won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation.
I think personally the president is pretty superstitious and he's been very interested in recreating the same situation as 2016, where he refused to say that we'll have to wait and see if he would concede the race if he lost at the time. Look, I was with Joe Biden actually when he found out about Trump's comments, and the former vice president just sort of blew Trump off and said, this guy just says the craziest things, whatever. I've covered a few politicians who have refused to concede their very contentious races. And it really, you know, the strength of this political system is that it's really not up to them. It is up to the other lawmakers, the other officials who have a hand in this election. And I think that's what's important to keep in mind here. In a very contentious Senate race in the 2014 cycle, a candidate named Chris McDaniel refused to concede after a runoff election against his opponent, the late Senator Thad Cochran. Cochran went on and won. And McDaniel to this day has not conceded that race. And the same thing happened in the Alabama Senate race with Doug Jones. The Republican candidate, Roy Moore, refused to concede and yelled about voter fraud and that the election was rigged. But the Republican Secretary of State just said, look, there's nothing I can do. And there have been a number of Republican lawmakers this morning who have been saying, we're going to have a peaceful transfer of power one way or another.
Now, I can't resist it because you mentioned it. So you were out in the field with Joe Biden. How's he doing on the stump? We see these pictures where he has to be behind a mask, can't shake hands, and that's important for him. He's a very sort of touchy-feely politician. Is the mask thing, the pandemic thing, really sort of cramping his style? How did he seem to you if you were there with him close up?
You know, he said himself during a stop yesterday that, yeah, it is inconvenient for him. You know, he's a tactile politician is how he described himself. And he is used to shaking hands and, you know, getting close and really listening closely to voters. But John, everybody should be wearing a mask in public. That's not like a style thing. That is not a tell about Joe Biden's health or caution. That is just proper safety for oneself and others. He does seem more vital than Republicans are portraying him as. There's a strong sense, a strong attack line that Republicans are trying to stick right now that Joe Biden uses a teleprompter every time he speaks. He never leaves his house. He refuses to be seen in public, all of which is not true. He is able to form complete sentences. So we have one candidate who can do that. And he does travel and does make multiple stops, but he's just trying to follow the science as we try and weather this disease right now.
I am prone to worry and anxiety, Daniel, which is, as regular listeners will know. But listen, that's been a fantastic conversation. And Daniel Strauss, senior reporter for Guardian US, thanks so much for joining us this week.
Thanks for having me.
Now, next week, we're doing things a little differently. The first presidential debate between Joe Biden and Donald Trump takes place on Tuesday night, which is the early hours of Wednesday morning, UK time. I'll be up, and once the debate is over, I'll be joining up with a colleague to discuss who won, who lost, and what it all means for this extraordinary presidential race. So look out for that first thing Wednesday morning, UK time. It could be explosive. Our regular Politics Weekly episode covering UK politics will then go out on Thursday, and you'll be able to find both of them in our usual feed wherever you get your podcasts. But for now, it's goodbye. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.